The contingencies would be opting to do bridge loans at lower leverage, right? Because if you're going in at a lower leverage, it's easier to refi out that lower leverage loan rather than being suffocated with a higher leverage. So you can always make your life easier with going in at a lower leverage. That's not a very popular thing to do though, right? Everyone, like the real estate business is fueled by debt, and it's what really drives returns is through that arbitrage of cheap debt. So if you don't go with lowering leverage, then it's really about finding deals that justify and support the high leverage.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am so absolutely thrilled to introduce our guest for the day, Rob Beardsley. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Just so excited to have you on. I mean, you're someone whose book that I've read more than once and really appreciate your expertise on underwriting. I'm a professional underwriter. I came from the institutional world. And so just having somebody who's like really focuses on that is so important to me. So thanks so much for being here, everyone. Rob oversees acquisitions and capital markets for Lone Star Capital, and he's acquired over $100 million of multifamily real estate. He's evaluated thousands of properties using his proprietary underwriting model and published the number one book on multifamily underwriting. So excited to have you on the show. Why don't you take us back in time, Robin, and help us understand how and why you got into real estate investing?
Sure. So I grew up in Silicon Valley with two major influences. My parents ran a residential brokerage firm from home. So they bought and sold luxury real estate for their clients. And on the side, they did some development and fix and flips. And the other major influence was growing up in Silicon Valley, a lot of tech startups, you know, the big tech companies and things like that. So while I grew up in a real estate household, I went to school to study computer science, and I thought I would go in the tech or consulting path. But while in college, I was just kind of doing my own research and looking at investing in the stock market or doing real estate, whether that be single family or multifamily or other things. And I really just gravitated towards multifamily because I already understood the single family business well based on my family's background. But I just really liked multifamily because it was so much more scalable and you can actually build a better business around it and produce cash flow and grow your wealth over a long period of time. The thing that I struggled with was, you know, my parents worked really hard doing all these deals, but they never really had anything to show for it. They weren't accumulating assets. They weren't building wealth over time. And so that was the exact opposite of what I wanted to do. I wanted to focus on being able to create growing wealth. So that's what really got me excited about multifamily.
Awesome. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And how did that fit in with, I mean, you briefly mentioned like looking at stocks, like how did multifamily kind of compare to stocks investing?
Well, it's tricky because I feel like with real estate as a general asset class, there's so much more in your control. And so you can control your own destiny better. And I think the other things about real estate that really differentiate it, and if you just look objectively at things, you go, oh, wow, this is a no-brainer. The biggest one, I think, is tax benefits. That's amazing. If you're able to position yourself to take full advantage of the tax benefits available associated with real estate investing, it's really incredible, and I don't think it can be beat. So that's a big one. And the other thing that's really interesting and conducive with my delayed gratification and long-term mindset is the illiquidity nature of real estate over stocks. I'm human, just like all of us, and I'm emotional. And that being an emotional human are not good things when it comes to investing in the stock market, because you've got instant liquidity. You can change your mind at any time. You can buy, sell. And doing that sort of thing is usually not good for your investment results. With real estate, you actually have the illiquidity of it, which forces you to be less emotional. You can't, if you wake up tomorrow and go, I need to sell my 200 unit apartment building tomorrow, you can't. It can't happen that fast. So it really forces you to think through your decisions and really just think longer term, which I think is conducive to performance.
Yeah, I never heard it described in that way, but I really appreciate that viewpoint, that it forces you to be more methodical and thoughtful. And, you know, you can't kind of be so impulsive about it once you're in it. And if you're an impulsive person, like, I mean, I certainly can be, I'm human. It's just like, it forces you to move more slowly and methodically. So really like that. Do you think that, you know, just thinking back to your parents, I mean, obviously we all have a lot to thank our parents for. Do you think they just didn't know how to invest? Because seems like they were probably making decent money. Did they just not know how to turn that into assets, would you say?
Yeah. So I think there are two fundamental issues that I think many people, right, the majority of the middle class struggles with, and that's lifestyle creep and just not really taking the lessons of Rich Dad Poor Dad to heart of, you know, here's your income, here's your expenses, you need to take the difference and start buying assets. And they didn't feel that they were ever in a position to do so because they had so many current liabilities. There's so many expenses going out the door on a monthly basis that, you know, there's no way that we can take all this money off the table right now and put it into a long-term investment. And we won't see this money for years, right? That was out of their realm. That was out of their reality. They couldn't imagine doing that because they had such a need for capital right then and there. And so that's kind of a mindset shift that people who want to get into this game and really build wealth long-term is you need to switch it around and say, okay, instead of spending as much money today as possible, how can I invest as much money and just start growing that? Because it's really not super exciting at the beginning, but the more you build on it and it grows and then it compounds, right? It becomes really exciting. So that's the hard hump for most people.
That's such a good point. You know, it's what you just said, like, it's not that exciting at the beginning. Like, it's so true. It's just like, it's such kind of small numbers and like very incremental progress. No one really gives you a handshake when you're being frugal, right? Like, you don't get that handshake until after like you've kind of made it, so to speak, or I don't know, whatever that looks like. And for a lot of real estate investors, they continue to, you know, have. So that actually brings me to a question, which is like, well, you live in New York, and I mean, maybe you're past the point of needing to be frugal, but is like, obviously the cost of living in New York isn't low. So how did that fit into your real estate investing journey and your, you know, knowing you want to be frugal and kind of invest your ass, what you're the difference between what you earn and what you spend?
Yeah. So starting out, it was certainly a factor, and you could argue that it remains a factor, but I think the goal in my mind was, or is that it doesn't matter really where I live or how I live, my cost of living is going to be so much lower than my income that it's going to be, there's plenty of extra money to invest. And so it's inconsequential whether, you know, my living expenses are here versus here because my income is here, right? So it's kind of this aggressive, confident mentality that I'm making it, I'm going to make it, it's all working. So that's how I approached it. But I'd say outside of that, outside of choosing to live in New York, I mean, everything else is pretty frugal. It's a game. And I think if you want to be successful at anything, you have to gamify it. You have to have KPIs. Every single month, I track every dollar that I made. And then I have a percentage breakdown that I allocate towards certain things. So I say, okay, I made X amount of dollars this month. And right off the bat, I'm going to take a certain percentage. I think my percentage is about 50% for investments. I just take that right off the top and I put it in a different account. And I say, that's going to be for investing. And that just happens every single month. So, you know, before you know it, you're looking at the end of the year and say, oh, wow, I put all this money away to invest and I made these investments. And right, you're, you know, without really even stressing or forcing it, you're automatically investing, you know, you're making sure your investments are happening first.
For sure. Yeah. That's really cool. And so do you use any like specific tools that help you kind of keep track of your, what you're spending and what you're earning and gamify it? Anything that you might want to share with the listeners? It's okay if not, but I'm just curious like how you systematize that.
Yeah, sure. Nothing too fancy. I use Mint. I think Mint's a great app. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's addicted to Mint and kind of checking it every day and looking at different things coming in, things coming out. But Mint is a good one. And then, yeah, I just built myself a little simple Excel spreadsheet. It's based off of the concept called Profit First, which is from a book, Profit First, by Mike Michalowicz. He's a great business author. And so we actually apply this Profit First methodology to our properties and to our business. And so I really liked it. And so then I just took the same methodology and applied it to my personal finances. Just to give people a quick explanation on Profit First, the idea behind the book is that how many thousands of businesses, you know, small businesses in America and the world, and X% are unprofitable, right? So many of them don't make any money. And his concept is just start with profit first. If it's just 1%, do that, right? So when 10,000 comes into the business for that month, just take 1% and put it into a separate account, call it your profit account, and then run the business with everything else, right? Just make it work. And then if you succeed with one, go two, then five, 10, 20, right? And so you build up your allocations where, you know, you've got an operating account, payroll account, maybe a reserve account, a profit account. And so that's what we've done. We've applied that to our properties and to our businesses itself. And then, like I said, to my personal life. So that's just a simple spreadsheet. And it's not something that I really have made for external use. But now that we're talking about it, if anyone wants to reach out to me at the end of this podcast and get just a blank template of it, I'm happy to share it.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's a really great offer just as a starting point. But anyways, thanks for sharing that. I really, really like that. And, you know, you mentioned the phrase, I didn't repeat it, but I'll repeat it now. It's called lifestyle creep. And I love that you mentioned that because, I mean, it sounds like for you, it seems like your income is a lot higher than yours. Is that because you've avoided lifestyle creep?
Yeah, I would say it's just that simple.
And part of that's right, the gamification, right? Like you're keeping
right
in Mint and KPIs, et cetera. Yeah. It's like this whole thing, right?
It's more fun. It becomes more fun to save and invest than to spend, right? Then
that's I love the cool part. I think that's really cool. Like, it's not like this hard, unfortunate thing that you're having to do. It's like something that you're excited and motivated to do, and you're making choices along the way that, anyway, so that's really cool. So when did you get into syndication specifically? Were you doing that in college or at what point?
Yeah. So started looking at deals and getting involved in the community, going to meetups, going to conferences while still in college, and was basically driving myself crazy trying to learn multifamily, you know, keep up with my studies. And then eventually actually starting my business while still in school and dual tracking all that. So it was really crazy. And I ended up participating in some deals, raising capital. And then we got our own first large deal under contract. And that's when I just decided to take a leave of absence from school, go full-time multifamily. Shortly after we closed our first deal, it was, you know, one of the hardest things I've ever done. We had to raise a ton of money and do a lot of things that I had never done before. So that was a great experience. But doing that really gave us the building blocks, the relationships, and the momentum to go and, you know, do our next few deals and really start building out a proper business.
Wow. Did you ever finish college or no? I didn't know that about you. That's very awesome. I mean, you know, that's very interesting because like you just went, you know, all the way into real estate, right? And so what was that like? Like, did you ever think twice about not? I mean, obviously not. It seems like you're pretty comfortable with it, but like, was that ever a thought like maybe I should think about finishing it? Or were you just like, no, it doesn't matter. It's not worth anything.
Well, I mean, if you ask the traditional Russian side of my family, my grandma would love to see me go and finish school, but the process I'm a very pragmatic person. I don't mind not following the status quo. I don't mind doing things that seem different as long as I have good reasons and everything makes sense. And so I just looked at it as an objective decision where I was in a very fortunate position where I have a big safety net. If I completely fail, well, then guess what? You just go back to school, right? So I'm just right back to where I started. And I'm honestly not even any worse for wear. I'm actually better for wear because I have more life experience and, you know, I will learn a bunch along the way. So I really, you know, sitting down with my academic advisor, he was saying, go do it, you know, take the risk. And I went to Carnegie Mellon, which is a, you know, more of an engineering computer science school, but it also has a strong startup culture. And so there's actually a lot of kids that leave school to go and pursue a startup. Because of that, Carnegie Mellon has a flexible, indefinite leave of absence policy where you can leave and come back whenever you want, months, years later, and pick up right where you left off. There's no penalty. There's no restarting. You just pick up right where you left off. So when I looked at that, well, I'd be crazy not to, you know, pursue this opportunity and really try to make something happen.
That's so cool. I love it. I don't think I realized that. I went to that Tepper, the business school at Carnegie Mellon, but I didn't realize that. That's so cool. Okay. So how did you end up becoming like, you know, I mean, you're an engineer. So is that how you got super focused on underwriting? Like, tell me a bit about that.
Yeah. Numbers have always been very interesting to me. And when I got into the real estate business, kind of always want to figure out how things work. And so when you look at multifamily syndication, for example, the best way to really know how it works is through underwriting. And so that's what I really started to learn, train, and you know, that really helped me make sense of the business itself. And then also, of course, learn a very critical component of the business, which is sourcing, identifying, evaluating strong opportunities and building business plans and capital structures to take advantage of the opportunities. So yeah, that's what attracted me early on. And I felt compelled to really excel at that in order to actually be successful.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I know we can't give a whole underwriting course on multifamily in the space of this interview. Is there anything that you could share with the audience? What are you seeing happening right now in the space in general with regards to underwriting that you think listeners or investors should watch out for and things that, you know, rules of thumb that you think are relevant, especially right now?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah. So as we all know, there's very interesting things happening in the market right now. There's, you know, the economy has opened back up from COVID, and which has caused a lot of inflation. And that's certainly showing up in rent inflation. So rents are going up a lot. And also at the same time, cap rates are staying low and potentially even going lower. It's a fabulous time to be an owner. Values are just going up and properties are doing well. And with underwriting specifically, it's all about finding business plans and locations that make sense. Because I think one interesting thing that I'm noticing is this inflation wave is a tide that's lifting all boats. And so places or submarkets that really shouldn't have a lot of rent growth are experiencing a lot of rent growth. But if you look at the underlying population growth, job growth, and other trends like that, they're really not strong. And so that's why I think it's important to look beyond just the rent numbers and really focus on identifying locations and properties that have high potential for future continued growth, even after this, which in my opinion is this temporary wave of inflation subsides, right? You want to still be in a situation where you've got strong growth persisting. So that's kind of a due diligence idea, but that's what we're really, really focusing on because prices are so high across the board. So you have to find opportunities that you can pay that high price for, but make up for it because there's so much embedded growth in the investment. So we're doing that. We're finding value add deals and, you know, we're being optimistic with the rent growth assumptions that we can achieve through the business plan and through the organic growth and inflation that's occurring over the next 12, 24 months. And then the other thing I would like to mention is the situation with bridge loans right now. You know, we love agency loans because they offer the best rates, great terms, and 10-year loans, which is very conservative, right? It's very hard to go wrong with a conservative 10-year loan. But these days, so many deals are going bridge, and that's because cap rates are so low. So I would just caution people to not just take the bridge loans for granted and just make sure that they're comfortable with the bridge loan risk that they're taking. And what that means is when you're taking bridge loan risk, it's maturity risk. If you have a 3-year loan, that means you have to implement your business plan and figure out what to do with the property, whether it's to sell it or to refinance it, all within that time period of 3 years. So it may seem like a long time, but you know, if everything doesn't go right to plan, it can be a problem. Fortunately, we've been very successful with the bridge loans that we've done. And all the bridge loans that we've done so far, we've ended up refinancing out of them in about 18 months. So it is possible you can certainly execute, get in and get out of that bridge loan in 18 to 24 months. But you have to understand that if there is a certain issue or a delay, whether it be at the property or just the market has issues, then that 36 months may not be enough. And you want to have contingency plans
totally,
for that.
For sure. Would you do bridge loans in today's environment, or what would your contingencies be if you were in there?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The contingencies would be opting to do bridge loans at lower leverage, right? Because if you're going in at a lower leverage, it's easier to refi out that lower leverage loan rather than being suffocated with a higher leverage. So you can always make your life easier with going in at a lower leverage. That's not a very popular thing to do though, right? Everyone, like the real estate business is fueled by debt, and it's what really drives returns is through that arbitrage of cheap debt. So if you don't go with lowering leverage, then it's really about finding deals that justify and support the high leverage, which means that the return on cost, which is a kind of a way of saying your operating cap rate in the future, is high enough to support the debt. And that way, when you refi, you're able to pay off the loan with a new one, and there's some cushion there. It's always important to have a good deal, but when you have a bridge loan, it's even more important to have a good deal.
Yeah, for sure. So for you, what would you consider like a lower leverage? Like if you were going to go the lower leverage route, what would you consider to be a reasonable range?
Yeah. So standard bridge loans are getting done at 80% of cost today. I would say lower leverage would be 70% of cost.
Yeah. And then you guys operate primarily in the Houston market, right? You're buying primarily in Houston. So when you're looking at deals that like are going to meet that, that are going to justify potentially a higher leverage, is that like you're looking at particular submarkets, or what kind of deal within the Houston market is going to kind of make for that sort of situation where you could justify potentially higher leverage? And do you guys do higher leverage, or are you typically going in at like 70?
We do both. Our preference is for deals that support higher leverage. And like I said before, those types of deals have a superior yield on cost. And to expand upon that a little bit more, yield on cost is your stabilized NOI, right? So you might be buying the property with an in-place NOI of 1.5 million, but through your business plan, you're able to push the NOI to 2 million. And so that's your projected stabilized NOI. And then your cost factor is your purchase price and your capital expenditures. So you have some renovations to do and whatnot. So if you have your stabilized NOI divided by your project costs, and that's able to be pretty high, and most importantly, higher than the prevailing market cap rates, that means you've created real value. And then you're able to hopefully successfully refi out that high leverage bridge. Because you know the reason why we're spending so much time talking about maturity risk with these bridge loans is because if you're going in at, let's say, 80% loan to cost, your refi is typically going to be something like a 75% loan to value, right? So that means it's two different things. So not only are you going in at a lower percentage, right? 80 versus 75, you're also only able to get the refi based on purchase price, not based on your total cost. So that's the implication for, or the necessity for value creation in order to be able to pay off the existing loan. So we're just looking for deals that support that. And we stress that through exit tests. So we actually explicitly test that. We say, okay, after 36 months on the bridge loan, and we have to refi to pay this off, you know, what does that look like? You know, maybe we're going in with a $20 million bridge and our base case scenario calls for a $25 million refi. So, okay, great. You know, you're able to cash out $5 million. But in a downside scenario, what if the new loan is only $18 million? Well, then you'd actually have a capital call in that scenario. You'd have to actually put on the new $18 million loan and get $2 million of fresh equity to pay off the maturing bridge loan. And that's obviously something that we want to avoid.
Awesome. Well, thanks for breaking that down. I think that's like just a really important concept for people to start to wrap their minds around when they're looking at these types of deals. Why is it that you guys have chosen to focus on the Houston market?
We've chosen to focus on Houston because we started out looking at Texas more generally, and we found that Houston, compared to the other major metros, was a little more under the radar, yet still exhibited a lot of the same growth characteristics. And obviously the entire state is landlord friendly, job friendly, all the great things and headlines that we're seeing about Texas are true, including for Houston. So we felt that there was a bit of a discount to be had, especially if you were able to go into Houston and know what you're doing and buy in certain areas, because it is true. I mean, Houston has certain things that make it more of a challenging market as far as energy exposure, flood risk, and also supply. All the Texas major markets have issues with supply because it's very easy to build. And so if you're able to kind of be more scrupulous and pick out certain submarkets where you're able to avoid the energy exposure, and not to say we don't buy in flood risk, but if you can buy outside the flood zone if you want, right? That's, it exists. You can do that. And then of course, staying away from submarkets where there's a lot of new supply. So it allows you to be a more nuanced investor and hopefully find underappreciated opportunity. So that's why we really dug in and have found success in Houston. But we still love the rest of Texas, and we do own in other parts of the state and hope to really make a meaningful splash in 2022 in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Okay, cool. Interesting. And you know, you mentioned the flood risk, and how do you characterize or work with that kind of, I mean, obviously there's insurance, but then there's the potential rise in insurance costs. How are you figuring into your underwriting, you know, potential flood risk in Houston?
So nothing too special. Kind of like you said, we have the insurance that we have to make sure that is up to our standards and up to the lender standards. So sometimes even if the property is not in a flood zone, if we feel that that area or property has history of flooding, then we'll opt for flood insurance, even if it's not in a flood zone. And so just taking the steps to be insured, I think, is really all you can do. Or you can just make the choice of, hey, I don't want to own in an area like this and deal with the headaches associated with potential flood risk. So, but we're comfortable with the risk and we're willing to deal with the consequences of a flood, which from what we haven't personally experienced a major loss. We've only experienced minor damage on our properties and been able to handle it. But from the experience that I've heard from others, the result of a major flood claim is usually that you actually make money on it, but it's just a nightmare, right? Getting paid out, there's delays, you have to fight with the insurance company, and it's not something you want to go through, but you're more often made whole with the claim, and then you rebuild the property and then you have a nicer property than you had before.
For sure. I think that makes sense. I guess one thing that comes to mind is like the increasing costs of insurance. Is that something that, you know, do you have a higher factor by which you're increasing insurance costs, and what would that be based on if so?
Yeah, so that's very true. Insurance costs are crazy. They have been crazy, and it's really all across Texas. I'm not sure how other states are, but you know, if you're not down by the coast and have flood issues, then it's windstorms and hail in North Texas. So it's just crazy across the board. And what we do is we just try to be very conservative with our underwriting upfront as far as insurance, and then hope. I mean, we're obviously always hoping to get the lowest cost possible, but what we underwrite is kind of like an outside or a higher scenario, but we just grow insurance at our regular expense growth rate. So we don't do anything fancy there. We do grow property taxes at its own growth rate because we have an understanding of the nuances of property taxes in Texas. And so we want to account for that.
Makes sense. Awesome. So is there any other aspects around underwriting that you want to maybe bring to light right now that investors can be looking out for?
Nothing's coming to mind.
Well, here's a question for you then, just like on underwriting in general. Do you have any rules of thumb around rent growth or expense growth that you would like to follow?
Yeah. So our historical rule of thumb was 2% rent growth for pretty much average locations, average demographics, and then 3% if it's a higher quality location. But these days, we're pretty much doing 3% on everything just because it's rent growth is far in excess of that. And, you know, would love to even push it to 4%, but I just think investors kind of have a mental wall with 3%, right? People are okay with 3%. Nobody's going to really look at your 3% assumption today and go, you're crazy. Because if you look around, it's happening everywhere much more. But yeah, so that's kind of the world that we're in right now. And I think the thing that we will consider doing next year is increasing our expense assumption to 3% as well, because we've always just had it at 2%, just standard inflation. But we all know that inflation is higher than that right now, and we've experienced it. It's probably going to continue. So it wouldn't be unreasonable to do that as well.
So then like next year, you might be doing 3% income growth and 3% rent growth, and 3% expense growth. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that makes sense. I think I would agree that there's kind of like this delineation between 3% growth and 4% growth, where 3% feels like, okay, that makes sense. 4% starts to feel a little bit speculative, even though it is happening. Can we continue to count on it happening? It just feels a little bit, there does seem to be a line right there. So that makes sense. And then you get to really overperform, right? When you sell a deal, I assume.
Yeah, that's always the goal. And it's happening all around us right now. It's a great time to be a seller.
Yeah, for sure. I want to also ask about cap rates and like how you like what kind of exit cap rate you're looking at and how you adjust the cap rate over time and if that changes deal by deal or market by market or at any point in time.
Yeah. So our general guideline for exit cap rates is to identify the prevailing market cap rate for the property that we are going to sell, and then apply 50 basis points of expansion to it. And then that's our exit cap rate. So to unpack that a bit, the prevailing market cap rate for what the property you're going to sell, it's kind of a loaded explanation, but what it means is when you're buying a value add deal and you're going to value add it and completely renovate, and it's going to be a stabilized deal, it's going to be a different cap rate. So you can't really compare the cap rate that you're buying the property at to the cap rate that you're selling at. You can look at them and it's good reference, but it's not really the best basis for your exit cap. So for example, right, you might buy a 3.5 cap and it's a value add deal. And then when you stabilize it, that same deal today shouldn't sell for a 3.5 cap. It should sell for maybe a 4, maybe a 4.25, because it doesn't have the same upside as the deal did when it was a value add. And so that's the idea. You want to identify, okay, well, what are deals very similar to the one I'm buying sell for when they're stabilized or for whatever condition I'm going to sell it at? And it's really hard to know that. And so what we do is we track every single deal we underwrite across the markets that we're in, and we keep cap rate data, yield on cost data, IRR data, price per unit. So a ton of data on all these acquisitions that we're looking at. We look at over 500 deals per year, and that's what informs our cap rate knowledge and assumptions for our underwriting. So we can confidently go, oh, okay, look, the average cap rate for X type of deal in the last 60, 90 days, or, you know, last year is this. So that way we're going to use that as our basis and then put whatever expansion or assumptions that we want. So that's how we approach it.
I mean, that is a pretty nuanced approach, really, to like be looking at all of those deals. And, you know, I mean, are you separating properties based on like their condition? And I guess, are there some metrics that you're using to kind of categorize different deals when you're looking at their cap rates?
Yeah, I would say size and vintage are two important ones. But for the most part, we're looking at deals all in the same size category. But you could understand that a smaller deal might have a lower or higher cap rate than a larger deal. Larger deals are more competitive and whatnot. But we're pretty much looking at deals in the 150 to 400 unit range. So that's all pretty similar. And then, of course, age is a big factor, right? You can't expect to pay the same cap rate for a 2005 deal as a 1975 deal. So that plays a big factor. And then, like we were talking about the business plan, right? If you're buying a deal that's half vacant, that could be a 2 cap, 1 cap, 0 cap, right? So that's not very informative of what market cap rates are. So you really have to focus on deals that have a stabilized performance to really get a sense of, okay, where are yields today? What are deals trading for? And we can tell the profile of a deal based on the going in cap rate versus the stabilized yield on cost. Because if it's really low to high, like if you're buying a 0 cap and you're stabilizing at a 7, you know that that was a big lift business plan where you're going from zero to hero. But there's plenty of deals that we're buying or looking at in our trade tracker that maybe it was a 4.5 cap. I can't say there's plenty of deals that have 4.5 cap. That's a unicorn these days, but let's say it's a 4 cap and then you're stabilizing at a 4.2, right? That's not a value add deal, right? You bought it, didn't really do anything with it, and that's that. So you can get a sense of the profile based on those yields.
So I guess that's interesting because I feel like when people have talked about cap rate expansion, they're usually talking about it in terms of the market changing and getting worse. But it seems like, I guess I like this approach of actually just looking at and seeing like, well, what are people willing to pay for this particular income stream once we've executed the business plan? It's just a different take.
Yeah, and we're still doing that assumption that the world is going to be worse. We're still doing the 50 basis points of expansion.
Okay, and then adding that on top of that. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, cool. And I'm just curious, like, have you ever considered investing in other asset classes besides multifamily, or are you just like really niching down into multifamily?
We haven't considered it seriously. We are going to launch a development strategy. So we want to develop suburban multifamily, but that's still in the multifamily food group.
Yeah, for sure. Totally. Yeah. I mean, that's exciting though. And that would continue to be in the Texas market. Like you would stay local to there. Very cool.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Rob, for sharing a lot of like very nuanced information about, you know, how you're looking at deals and underwriting them, et cetera. Really appreciate it. Would you please share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and anything else you want to share?
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate everyone's time. To learn more about us, you can go to our website, lscre.com. That stands for Lone Star Capital Real Estate. So lscre.com. On our website, there's a contact form. You can get in touch with us. And if you want to download my underwriting model for free, there's a link at the top to get that as well. So appreciate it.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I definitely hope you all take some time to check out Rob's stuff, and his underwriting model is an excellent free tool that you should take advantage of. So thanks so much, Rob, for coming on the show. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.